Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1972, Congress passed what's become a landmark piece of legislation, Title IX. Now, Title IX simply states, quote, "No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance," end quote. And that is it. But Title IX threw open the doors of educational opportunity for women in America, even beyond parity in college athletics. Today, women are a higher percentage of the student body than men on some college campuses, and women earn more doctorates than men, for example. Title IX was also the regulatory tool the Obama administration used to push back against campus sexual assault and later push for transgender accommodations. But Arshep Melnick says that within Title IX's very success lies the story of mission creep. And he writes that the evolution of Title IX is, quote, "a cautionary tale about how good intentions and broadly defined goals can become distorted over time by aggressive cultural combat." Well, Melnick is a professor of American politics at Boston College. His new book is called The Transformation of Title IX, Regulating Gender Equality in Education, and he joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So essentially, you're saying that there's been overreach using Title IX. What's your evidence for that?
Right. Well, you mentioned two of the big issues. One was the expansion of sexual assault regulations, which are extremely detailed. And the other was the transgender regulations that were set down by the Obama administration in the last year of the Obama administration, since have been withdrawn. One of the features of these is that they were all done basically through administrative fiat. Congress has not taken any further action on Title IX. And these were all issued not through the standard notice and comment rulemaking procedures that most agencies go through, but through so-called dear colleague letters,
right,
with no public participation. We can talk more about the specific rules and what they reach. But the part of the problem is the process, and there hasn't been very much process.
Well, so let's talk about the rules around transgender students, for example, and campus accommodations, because that's the most recent, really.
Right.
And as you write, you say it's the one that's come about most suddenly. So why do you think that that particular Dear Colleague letter was an overreach of Title IX?
Well, let me start with President Obama's original position on this, which was that he really thought it was important to have protections for transgender students.
Yeah.
He thought that had to come through legislation, and he proposed legislation, he backed legislation, and he refused to issue new regulations until it became clear that that legislation was going to fail. And then he reversed his position and said, well, I'll do this administratively. I really think that shows, number one, Congress's abdication of responsibility, which is, of course, no surprise, but also the extent to which regulation process has been used as a substitute for legislation.
Okay. So here's the thing. You're getting into deep – underlying what you just said is this idea that Title IX has gone from being a regulatory tool used to ensure parity – of a sort on college campuses, to a regulatory tool that's being used to change social norms or enforce new cultural rules or encourage new cultural rules. And what I couldn't figure out from your writing is whether you take exception to that. Is that an inappropriate use of Title IX? Or and if it is, is that something the government should be involved in at all?
Well, I'd say make two points about that. One is to appreciate the significance of the change, which was an extraordinarily ambitious one, as you pointed out, is to change social norms. And to change social norms often in the most intimate settings. One shorthand is to say that Title IX first was aimed at the classroom,
mm-hmm.
then it moved to the playing fields, and then it moved to the bedrooms and the bathrooms to change the way people think about what sex means, what sex is appropriate in the most intimate settings. So that is a very ambitious thing.
These are all on college campuses, though.
On college campuses, but also in elementary and secondary schools.
Okay. Places of education, yes. Right. So here I'll quote Assistant Secretary, I forget her first name, Lehman?
Catherine Lehman.
Catherine Lehman, right. After she left the office that she was overseeing, where Title IX is from, which Title IX is regulated, and she told an interview, the bathroom question, meaning transgender accommodations, never was just about a bathroom. It was about what that child is at school and how that child will be perceived and seen. And you write that Title IX, she implied, requires regulators to do all they can to change harmful ways of thinking. Now, of course, the obvious question to that is, well, why not? Because aren't harmful ways of thinking the ultimate root of what then leads to more concrete forms of discrimination?
I think you put your finger on the dilemma. Because that's absolutely true. On the other hand, in a liberal democracy, we are very cautious about having government tell us how to think about very private things. We sometimes allow government to do that, but we usually expect Congress to act on that. We don't expect that type of regulation of thought, really is regulation of thought, to be done in this administrative kind of non-participatory way. And when I say thought, if you look at the sexual harassment rules that were promulgated by the Office for Civil Rights and mirrored in many colleges' codes, they talk about behavior that has innuendos of sexual behavior. Get a very detailed understanding of what we can and what we cannot say. That's a pretty serious threat to freedom of speech, and that shows why once you start going down that road, you run into a lot of constitutional issues.
You know, you write in some detail about how Title IX rules have been issued over time, and you say that there's been a process that you're calling institutional leapfrogging, right? That's been going on. Tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that.
Sure. Title IX gives power to administrative agencies, the Office for Civil Rights, to write regulations. The courts are also very much involved in interpreting what Title IX requires. So by leapfrogging, I mean the process by which the agency takes a small step, the court expands upon that, the agency then expands on what the court did, and then you go back and forth, so there's this institutional growth. Where no one really thinks ahead of time about what is going to be at the end of that road.
So let me ask you, and this might sound like a bit of a gauche question, but that sounds utterly normal to me. Is that not how regulations get developed? Or are you saying that the superior process is the one of institutional rulemaking where there's public processes that are involved as well?
Well, that's a good point. To some extent, this happens in a variety of areas. What is distinctive is the lack of much more sustained rulemaking deliberation. So, for example, I used to study the Environmental Protection
Agency. I was just going to say the EPA is probably a good counterexample.
Their rulemaking procedures are unbelievably elaborate. They produce so much information. They have so many comments. They respond to comments. And one of the consequences of that, and I think this is for those of us who are extremely distrustful of the Trump administration, one of the consequences of that is that when you do regulations that way, they're hard to undo because you have to go through the same process to undo them. And that's what's been going on in EPA. They can't just revoke these things.
Yeah.
When you do something through a dear colleague letter, it can be revoked just like that by an administrator.
Huh, interesting. Now, you ask two really interesting questions, or actually a multiplicity of interesting questions, but two of the more interesting ones that in the time that we have left that I wanted to explore with you are, you write that providing equal athletic opportunity, preventing sexual assault, dealing with those who are experiencing gender dysphoria, that these are all laudable objectives, you say. But you ask, did Congress authorize such administrative action when it enacted Title IX nearly a half century ago? Now, I would say the obvious answer is no, right? Because that was a half century ago. But, you know, in 2018, 2010, whatever, in the modern day, we have a series of imperfect tools, right? We have Congress, we have the courts, and we have the regulatory power of the executive. I mean, wouldn't a lot of people say that out of those series of imperfect tools, Title IX is the best of those?
That's another good point. I'll put it this way, that when Congress is not doing very much to legislate, We look to other sources. We look to courts. We look to agencies. We look to states. And that's inevitable. I think we need to look at some of the imperfections in the process that arise as a result. And I'll use athletics as the example. When I started writing this book, I thought I have one example I'm really concerned about, which was what I think overreach and sexual harassment. And the other was athletics, which I thought was, at the time, was really a terrific example of good regulation. The cover has a picture of a girl with a lacrosse stick, and that is meant to signify my daughter who played lacrosse, and I think that was really terrific for her. What I learned was that the process of regulation had this very unfortunate consequence, which is it focused almost entirely on varsity athletes, which are a very small percentage of all women athletes and all men athletes. We have lavished enormous resources on them, including not just money, but admission slots. And it destroyed the old, and I think, superior model of women's sports, which was it was an extracurricular activity that was equal or even less important than scholarship. And unfortunately, because of the way the regulations were written, we have led women's sports down the awful path that men's varsity sports has taken.
Now, you can't really be saying that to the hundreds of thousands of young girls who go, you know, who are playing sports now in high school, and the many thousands of them who go on to play college athletics, that the system now is worse than it was when their mothers or grandmothers were shut out of playing sports. You can't really be saying that.
Right. I'm not saying it's worse. What I'm saying is that there are two factors in operation here. One was this huge cultural shift, of which Title IX was just one part. And I'd say all of the changes that you described at the beginning that are very important, those we see in every advanced democracy. So there is this huge cultural change. And Title IX is one part of that. So what I would argue is that the specific form that regulation took tended to put most of the emphasis of government's pressure on one part of the athletic process, and that was varsity athletes. Mm. And I want to say something in favor of the Obama administration here, which is they were the first ones really to say, let's pay attention to what happens in elementary schools and in high schools, because there the inequalities between women's sports and men's sports is dramatic, especially for minority children. And they have started to make some changes there, and I think that's a much better use of government authority than to push for more varsity athletics.
Yeah. So this is such a complex and fascinating conversation. We've only got a minute to go, Professor. But I guess I'm wondering now where we are in 2018. If not Title IX, then what? Because I don't hear you saying that discrimination doesn't exist on campuses or schools and that we shouldn't be doing anything about it. But what other tool do we have or should we be using?
I see nothing wrong with using Title IX to address issues such as sexual assault. And as we look forward at what's going to happen, there's some bad news and there's some good news. The bad news is that the president is not someone you trust to address these issues, and I've got to say the Secretary of Education isn't either. I'd say two points of good news. One is that for the first time, the Office for Civil Rights has decided to go through a much more deliberative process. Mm. And I think that we have learned a lot about the problem of sexual assault and how we can square that with due process than we knew 5 or 6 years ago. The other is that I do think that the new Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights and Department of Education, Ken Marcus, is a relatively experienced and thoughtful person, which distinguishes himself from many Trump appointees. And so I think we can look forward to see what that process produces.
So it sounds like you're calling for more deliberative processes regarding Title IX.
Absolutely.
Well, R. Shep Melnick is a professor of American politics at Boston College, and his book is called The Transformation of Title IX, Regulating Gender Equality in Education. It's an absolutely fascinating read. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.